Hello and welcome to Film Weekly with me, Zan Brooks. This week we venture through the shacks, forests and cattle yards of Missouri's Ozark Mountains with Winter's Bone, a brilliant new drama from director Deborah Granick. We'll be talking to her in just a moment. Now, last week, while Jason Solomons and I were hanging out in Venice, getting loaded and dancing with movie stars, our Guardian colleague Henry Barnes was stuck here on a mission to find out what's playing at next month's London Film Festival. Henry is here to tell me all about that, and we'll also be reviewing the week's big releases, including The Kid, I'm Still Here, and the French zombie horror, The Horde. All that and more on this week's Film Weekly.
You better just tell me.
You know your daddy's out on bond, don't you?
So what?
Looks like he's been cooking again.
I know that's the charges you laid on him, but you ain't proved it on him. You gotta prove it every time.
Well, that won't be no hard thing to do. But that ain't even why I'm here. His court date's next week, and I can't seem to turn him up.
Maybe he sees you and ducks.
It could be. But where you all come into this is, he put this house here and your timber acres up for his bond.
He what now?
Jessup signed over everything. If he doesn't show at trial, see, the way the deal works is, you all gonna lose this place. You got some place to go?
I'll find him.
Girl, I've been looking.
I said I'll find him.
The local sheriff revealing the hard truth to 17-year-old Ree Dolly in a scene from Winter's Bone, which is out this week. Now, Ree is played by newcomer Jennifer Lawrence in a performance that's already being tipped for awards. And the film itself is a tense, backwards drama about a girl on the trail of her fugitive dad, making a last-ditch attempt to keep a hold of the family home. And yet, the deeper Ree goes, the more secrets she uncovers. The woods are full of cousins and uncles, but they're all up to no good, and there's stuff that they're just not saying. And joining me now to shed some light on this murky tale is Deborah Granick, the film's director and co-writer. Deborah, welcome to Film Weekly.
Thank you.
Now, I was reading your biography, which says that you were born in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and raised in Washington, D.C., and are now based in New York. So what drew you to make a film in the Ozark region of southern Missouri?
I was drawn to this region through reading Daniel Woodrell's novel, which is the novel that is the basis for this film. And it was a very particular and precise description of this girl's life in a place that I could not really conjure in my imagination. I mean, in a country as big as the United States, regions define you tremendously, and they limit you. And you, unless you make it a life's effort, you don't get to know other regions. You're limited by your own geography, and mine is pure East Coast, you know, the Eastern Seaboard. And Ree's life had a huge amount of texture, as described by Daniel, but the specifics were truly foreign to me. I mean, the way she heats her house, the way it's common for people in her family and her community to use wild game to supplement their diet. You know, there were many daily life experiences of this girl that I knew I would have to go down there to see. Was he creating a hyperbole? Is it 2010? You know, I needed to see for myself how Daniel's novel would marry with reality. And that is truly what drew me down there.
Tell me about the Ozark region then. I mean, which still seems to be dismissed as the sort of black hole at the center of America. I mean, it's regarded by, I guess, liberal intellectuals as sort of backward and conservative. And on screen, we still mainly know it, I guess, from Deliverance or as the first home of the Beverly Hillbillies, apparently. But presumably you had to kind of steep yourself in that culture and see beyond those kind of stereotypes.
Indeed. And, you know, it's interesting how I feel like there will always be something a little bit radical about hill culture. And I find this to be, I think this is true. I'm not an anthropologist, but I am wildly speculating, but that seclusion can definitely cause certain kinds of cutoffs that maybe can work against people's overall evolution, but also certain kinds of seclusion truly intensify a culture in terms of dialect and music, in terms of ways of survival, in terms of not getting bigger, better, more. And that was extremely revelatory for me, because you know, there's just a part of being a coastal person where every aspect of life is defined by a kind of ambition, and that ambition usually is linked to material accumulation, and that was not what I think that's not what we found when we got down there. Finally, this kind of sage-like woman that we relied on, who ended up being the singer and music advisor for the film, she said, "Oh, didn't you know that, you know, there's a saying that goes so deep here, and it's not just a saying. It literally is sort of the law of the land, which is use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without." And you know, she's like, no one can live in hill culture and not have that be part of their foundation.
This is the singer. Is it Meredith Sisko? Is that right?
Yes, that is the woman I'm referring to.
Who sings an astonishing song in the middle of the movie? I was reading though that she said that she had to clean up some of the lyrics to the Missouri Waltz because the original versions were kind of racist.
I think that's true. You know, it's funny. I've only had she's also a really talented researcher about lyrics and music and music rights and traditional ballads and whatnot, and I've actually only seen the two versions that were lyrical and, you know, had nothing that rubbed me the wrong way. But I know that I don't know the words of the version she's talking about. But I do know that the song was created at a time when understandings about social things and about racism was very different.
Tell me about the casting of the film, because I know you have some locals who are in supporting roles, but I guess at least one key to its success is the casting of Jennifer Lawrence in the central role of Ree. Was that a long hunt? Did you have to kind of audition many, many actors to find her?
We did. The hunt was long, and the hunt was so difficult in the sense that first we started with women that were, you know, much older, because the notion was that what has become almost the law in financing an independent film is that, you know, you have to find a financeable star or a lead. And finally, we had to go rogue. There was no one ultimately that could sort of stand behind, you know, this another way of casting the film. And it was for us a truly lucky day that, as we had seen many young women auditioning on a certain day, Jennifer was among them, unannounced. You know, we didn't know who she was, and we weren't reading people's background. We were trying to perform the auditions, and where you just listen to someone. You know, you don't study their resume. You don't look at anything about their prior experience. You just experience them in that moment. And Jennifer read the script beautifully. It was, you know, though this may be lost on a British audience, you know, there are some very, very lyrical ways of pronouncing American English, I have to say. And I feel like Kentucky is one of them. And
so she's from Kentucky, which is kind of neighboring state.
Yeah, and her voice, when I heard it that day at the audition, I said to myself, this could be the voice of Ree Dolly. Mm. I believe this. It's not that Kentucky accent is the same as Missouri, but she had such an ear for the cadence and she had also done her homework. You know, she had asked her parents to explicate one or two of the phrases that were a little bit, you know, specific. I just knew that there was going to be some part of her life experience, not that her day-to-day life has anything to do with Ree's life, but that something culturally about where she's from in the United States would assist in her delving into this role. And I think that proved to be an important factor.
Spinning on from those little particular cultural distinctions, do you think that there's still a resistance within the American film industry to movies that are basically set in the American heartland? There's this sort of assumption that if it's not in New York or L.A., that no one will actually want to go and see it.
I think that has been, you know, I don't want to slag off people, and I've been known to shoot off my mouth, but I literally, and this is overly simplified on my part, but I sort of became so dogmatic this year just saying, no, there are other zip codes in this vast nation besides 90210.
Yeah.
You know, not every American lives poolside. Not every American is able to partake in the myth of affluence. And it's like, what happened to the rest of the country? And I think it took a really, truly soulful, open-minded, open-hearted Irish sociologist to, like, write this extremely touching book about what's happening in the American heartland.
You must, though, be feeling pretty vindicated now, because Wintersbone won the jury prize at Sundance, and there's already kind of talk of possible awards for Jennifer Lawrence. I mean, are you surprised that it has broken through the way it has? Did you expect it to have a much more low profile?
We absolutely did. I mean, we are surprised in a way that is, you know, it is a kind of validation saying, okay, not for me, but for any filmmaker, for me and colleagues, you know, it's saying, okay, is there room in the marketplace for smaller films? This is exciting to us. Can films be made more humbly? Can they be made frugally? Can they be about specific places? And is there any chance that a film can ever succeed without a star that got it its financing, you know? I still don't know how to solve the latter and how to reproduce that scenario, but it did. It excited us because it felt more possible. After all the naysaying, it felt possible.
You know, congratulations. I think it's a terrific film, and thank you for joining us on Film Weekly.
Very appreciated.
And Winter's Bone is on UK release from Friday, the 17th of September. Now, joining me to review the week's releases is The Guardian's Henry Barnes. But let's start with The Kid, which is the British film. It's the second film from actor-turned-director Nick Moran. His first was the biopic of Telstar producer Joe Meek, which actually I didn't think was too bad. But here he is back with another true story, supposedly. Is it a good one?
Yeah, it's based on a book by Kevin Lewis, and the book's about his horrible upbringing in his house where his mum was a thumper and his dad was a boozer.
So it's like a kind of misery memoir.
It's a horrible misery memoir. It's almost unrelentingly bleak. Poor old Kevin gets hit at home, gets beaten about at school, gets caned, and his upbringing leads to a point where he becomes something of a street fighter to support himself.
But eventually, he does turn his life around. So there's a lesson that we can all learn from this story.
Thumping your way to success.
Yeah. I mean, we've all tried it. So does it work? I mean, you know, misery memoirs are sort of a dime a dozen these days. Mm-hmm. What's sort of special about this one?
As a film, I don't think it is particularly special. It does that weird thing of taking an incredible story and turning it into actually a rather dull film. It's almost like Nick Moran's trying to make The Diving Bell and The Butterfly meet Snatch.
Right.
That's
the kind of a brave, that's a sort of brave, audacious thing to try and do. It's like some mad scientist in a laboratory.
It's a mad scientist. There's some mad bits at work. There's an incredibly harrowing scene where Rupert Friend, who plays Kevin, is getting beaten up by both mum and dad at the same time. Mm. And it's very dark. It's very shadowy existence that he lives. But you do get that real feeling and you start to really feel for his character. Then unfortunately you go to the next scene where he's at school and you've got Madness and Kim Wilde playing in the background because it's the 80s.
Right, oh yeah, we were all listening to it back then, Henry. You're too young to remember those days.
It might well be, but it's also that cliched idea of this 80s environment that he's growing up in.
Yeah.
And it just takes you completely away from the character and from his predicament.
Another problem that I had with it is that it seemed just almost comically miscast. I mean, I think Rupert Friend can be a good actor, but he's not altogether convincing as a kid from the wrong side of the tracks who's a bare-knuckle boxer. Hmm. He doesn't really look like he could take care of himself.
Although the guy who wrote the book, Kevin Lewis, he's not exactly convincing
really?
Himself.
I mean, right.
There's a short...
It's always the ones you least suspect, isn't it?
Exactly. There's a short clip of interview at the end where he goes on Richard and Judy because his book becomes one of their must-reads. And his voice is very like this, and his very kind of effeminate voice.
Like Mike Tyson.
And yeah, Rupert Friend actually does that pretty well. You know, he does the effeminate... But macho fighter.
Okay, well, I'll give you that. But what about Natasha Mechelen as his mum? Now, Natasha Mechelen has become like this sort of icon of classiness in both films, both here and over in the States. And yet here she's playing, you know, Kevin's horrible old alky mum with her thick specs and a sort of permanent fag in her gob.
Yeah.
And it just didn't quite work.
Oh, it's a clanger, isn't it?
It is.
There's a fantastic bit where she beats him up for the fourth or fifth time and then says, "Clean yourself up and get to school." And you just think, what?
And she's always saying, fucking hell.
Fucking hell.
And it just doesn't really sound right.
I think it said
her.
In the press notes that she felt like it was a real challenge and a departure.
Well, it was.
And it looks it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a full credit to her for taking it on, but I don't think it quite works. And I didn't really like, I mean, this is sort of trying to be sort of Britain's answer to Precious, isn't it? But it just ends up a bit crude and manipulative.
It's crude, it's manipulative, it's a bit mawkish.
Yeah.
And it's also slightly unbelievable. I think there's that air of a story that's being told by the person who experienced it. And I don't deny that he had a horrible upbringing and he's done really well for himself to come out of it. But the film paints it as a saintly story of one man's rise out of this hellhole.
Yeah.
And he's also actually quite a violent bloke throughout most of the film.
Well, let's not slag it off too much then. Talking of unbelievable, Henry, let's move on to I'm Still Here, mm-hmm. which played in Venice last week. We spoke about it then, but I'm interested to get your thoughts on it because it is one of those films that the more you think about, I don't know, the more interesting it becomes in a way. This is Casey Affleck's reputed Waltz and All Access All Areas documentary of his brother-in-law, the actor Joaquin Phoenix, who announces that he's sick of movies, he's giving up that acting career, and he's going to become a rapper. And the film follows him through, I guess, a long, dark night of the soul that goes on for like a year. It's supposedly all true, and yet Casey Affleck kind of accepted the notion that some of the scenes may well have been a little bit staged. And this obviously opens up a can of worms where people are then saying, is the whole film a fiction? Here's a clip of Joaquin in his new guise as a rap artiste, taking some wisdom from Sean Diddy Combs.
Obviously, you had great success in film and music. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to be something...
Do you have money, though? Do you have money to do this?
Like, how much? I mean, I have a little studio, do you know? Like, in my garage, got Pro Tools set up.
See, that's a mother problem. When people try to do things, they don't do it the way they do it for their own industries. When you go make a movie, you got money to make a movie, right?
What I want it to be is, like, a place of true exploration.
Can you do that in acting?
Well, I do. That's the thing is that as an actor, you're shielded. It's a different, you know, I mean, you know this, Christ.
No, that's not a different thing.
But you
lights, right?
Shit.
Lights, okay. Lights.
Yes, how much?
Craft services.
Yeah, it costs a lot.
Trailers. Yeah. Makeup, hair, DP.
Good point.
Gaffers.
I get it.
Same thing. Studio, engineer.
I got it.
Me.
Wow.
Me.
Yeah, you.
The speakers.
I get it.
Do you have any money?
Well, how much you need?
How much you got?
Henry, is this a hoax or is this strictly on the level?
I've got a feeling this might come back and bite me in the ass, but I think it's a complete hoax from start to finish.
You think it's all concocted?
I don't know if I'm giving both Casey Affleck and Joaquin Phoenix too much credit by saying it, but I think he is being manipulative and the whole thing is a hoax throughout.
Why? What made you think that?
I think when we got to the Letterman clip, there's this famous clip where he went on Letterman about halfway through his breakdown,
yeah,
for a junket of the last film he did before he retired, which was Two Lovers with Gwyneth Paltrow. And Letterman basically bullies him and says, you know, come on, come out and give us a quote about this film, why are you retiring? And JP sits there, says very little, and is basically laughed at as sort of a lion circus by the audience. Mm. And I just saw a twinkle in his eye or some sort of nod to camera when Letterman was doing his bit for it, that everybody might be in on it, and this is just a big joke on
So when you say everyone's in on it, you think in that scene Letterman's in on it too?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't think that at all. Ah. I think Letterman was certainly looking for an opportunity to have some fun with this guy.
Yeah.
But I don't think he was in on it.
I thought if it was real, he was being unnecessarily cruel, as was Casey Affleck by making the film.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think Casey Affleck certainly would be accused of rampant cruelty if it was all real. Because basically, you know, this is his brother-in-law. This is a friend.
Yeah.
And he shows him snorting coke off the breasts of hookers.
Yeah.
He shows him being in the most sort of scene that everyone talks about, where he's being defecated on by his vengeful PA.
Now, I watched carefully.
Yeah.
And there was no actual defecation taking
There's
place.
There's a sort of shadow of something falling.
So at least that's
I
a
don't
hoax.
Want to know any more than that. That was a scene, though. I mean, it's a funny scene, but that's a scene that almost kind of blows the lid off the film, doesn't it?
Yeah. Because
you think, come on, there's no way that that's
it becomes
real.
Slightly farcical at that point, yeah. But there is a lot of it that you could conceivably believe is actually happening, particularly JP's awful rapping, which isn't that much worse than many kind of so-called hip-hop stars that you'd see today. And there's scenes where he goes in into the studio with Sean P. Diddy, Puff Daddy Coombs, and I don't think P. Diddy's in on it, because he's watching him, and you actually see this guy actually...
He
really
looks so horrified.
He looks horrified, yeah. But he's also feeling for him and thinking, God, this guy's really trying to make it in this new career, and it's as hard as the old one.
We're coming at this from very different angles, because I thought that P. Diddy was in on it.
Right.
I think that he was. Yeah. I don't think Letterman was. And I think that this is such an example of fence-sitting here, but I think it's all staged and all fictitious, and yet there's a kind of truth to it too. Yeah. But I think that Joaquin Phoenix is in some kind of meltdown. But he's playing a character in Meltdown in a weird way.
That might be right, yeah.
And time, I guess, will tell.
I think ultimately he is fed up of being in the movie business. And that might have been the true inspiration for this whole thing to start off. But I would be reluctant to say he's actually having a breakdown to the extent that you see on the screen.
Yeah, maybe
I don't
not.
Think you'd want to see him do that.
Having said all that, did it work for you as a film or not?
It did. It was awful. Like him, it was awful flabby. There's a lot of stretch in it, and there's countless scenes where he goes on stage in places like Miami and will do a hip hop set for people, and it doesn't go that well, and something disastrous will happen, like he jumps into the crowd to fight a heckler, and then the scene after is him in some anonymous hotel suite shaking his head and clawing his greasy old hair that he's grown, and they just go on and on and on and on, and I understand that that's going on for him too, if this is a real thing, but it's too much for us as the audience to take for me.
That's I'm Still Here, which I think is well worth seeing, whether you believe any of it or not. Henry, you haven't seen Winter's Bone, but I would really recommend that you see that, because it's absolutely superb. Another film that I've seen you haven't is The Horde.
Yes.
A French zombie film.
I heard this was cops and robbers and zombies.
Well, it's quite weird because I guess if you're giving it a bit of credit, you could say it's a genre hybrid, you see. It starts out and there's like cops doing a stakeout on these gangsters at the top of a high-rise tenement outside Paris. And you're going along with that. And then all of a sudden the whole place is invaded by zombies. And the cops and the criminals have to join forces to get out alive.
I think I read about a similar thing in New York a couple of years back.
It happens all the time. Yeah. Now, one thing that is fascinating about this film is that it credits no fewer than 5 screenwriters. 5 people sat down, worked really hard over their word processors.
5 different types of...
Exactly. And this is what they came out with. That's The Horde, a French zombie film that basically, I don't know, it involves a lot of biting, a lot of punching, a lot of guns going off, people running down dark stairways screaming. And that's kind of it.
Is there a love interest there?
There's a kind of weird love interest in there, but... As is the way with so many love interests in zombie horror films, they get killed very, very quickly. Mm. They're gone. Now, if you're wanting to get very kind of sociological about this film, and of course we do, you could say that there's a social commentary here in that it's set in this sort of tenement block in an area that's being gentrified and all the tenants are being forced out. You've got sort of racial minorities as the criminals, and you've got this old racist caretaker in the block who refers to the zombies as chinks. So, you know, maybe that's there, but it feels very much bolted on. Mm. It's like a sort of a head that's hanging off that's about to sort of fall in a splat of blood.
In Prophet with Teeth.
That's really, you've said that now, and that's going to be on the poster. And that is going to come back and bite you on the ass.
That is going to haunt me.
Quite literally.
I've got to ask as a final thing, Zan, are they fast zombies or slow zombies? Because there was a big debate about this on the Guardian message board.
They're quite fast, but only when the script that was written by five script writers dictates that sometimes they come flying at you and you're dead before you know it. Mm. And other times they kind of shamble and give the characters that we like a chance to get away. So it's very complicated. There's a whole architecture of zombie speed that's going on here that you've got to watch the film maybe five or six times to really understand, and that's another
that's quote, definitely going,
that's
on,
going on the poster. Now the leaves are turning brown and the nights are drawing in, which means it's that time again, the season of the London Film Festival, and by God it seems to come round quicker each year. The full lineup of movies was announced last week, and Henry Barnes went along to find out just what we can look forward to. Henry, what are your first impressions? Does this look a good list to you?
I think it does look like a good list. I mean, as ever, it's going to be a pick and mix of the stuff that's already been at Cannes, Venice and Toronto, which is an unfortunate byproduct of the positioning of the festival at this time.
It's only unfortunate for critics and journalists, though, isn't
Absolutely.
It? To other people, it doesn't matter a damn.
It's a very insular point of view, yeah. I know. So you do have high-profile things like Mike Leigh's Another Year showing here, which is
great.
Very well. Cannes is a great film that more people in London should see, absolutely. You've also got Black Swan by Darren Aronofsky, which was at Venice.
I missed it at Venice, so I really want to see it.
So you're going to see it here?
Yeah.
And then The King's Speech as well, which was at Toronto. So that was the one starring Colin Firth. King Charles V, is that right? I'm not sure.
Well, we'll change that in the edit. another film that was at Cannes that was really good is a lesser known film called My Joy.
Yeah,
which is this really sort of black, dark Ukrainian road movie, I guess, that I really thought was going to win some kind of award in Cannes, and for some reason didn't.
Yeah,
and that's sort of worth checking out. But I also want to see, I do want to see The Black Swan. I do want to see Anton Corbijn's The American with George Clooney. Jason Solomon saw it and said that was superb. Mm. And there's a new documentary, Tabloid, by Errol Morris that I really want to see.
Right, right. And you've also got James Franco as the sort of George Clooney of this year's festival. George Clooney came last year with Fantastic Mr. Fox and Up in the Air, I believe.
Yeah.
And he was almost the celebrity for London. James Franco might be that this year.
The mascot.
Yeah, the mascot with 127 hours.
Because he's power. In the opening night film, or is it the closing night film?
It's in the closing night films. Closing night gala is Danny Boyle's 127 hours. And actually, I started my interview with Sandra Hebron asking her why it was important to have a British film as the opening night and closing night gala.
It wasn't particularly planned. You know, we don't have a remit to go out and find British films for opening and closing night. What we're always looking for is the sort of strongest, most interesting films that we can get. As it happens this year, and, you know, I'm very pleased about this, they are both British. They're kind of, you know, British and slightly not as well, in the sense that obviously Never Let Me Go is, you know, a British film with an American director, and 127 hours is a, you know, British director and lots of British involvement shot in America. So we are claiming them as British, and that's great for the festival. But it's not something that we sort of deliberately to set out to do.
And I suppose it's easier to find high-quality, high-profile British films if that idea of a British film is becoming more fluid.
Well, maybe, but in a sense, as I say, because we don't, you know, because we don't really start from, you know, the kind of nationality of a film. We start from, you know, is this a good story, well told? It then becomes, you know, if those films are British, however we're defining it, that's fortuitous. But it's not a, you know, it's not a defining characteristic of what we're looking for.
You said in your opening speech about the boundary between narrative and non-narrative cinema disintegrating. Could you explain what you meant by that?
Well, it's partly because, I mean, I think it ties into that idea too of, you know, fact and fiction blurring. And, you know, I was just struck this year that there are lots of films that are based on real events. Of course, you know, there are lots of documentaries in the festival, but films like Conviction and a whole series of others, you know, The Arbor, really kind of draw on fact, but they are not kind of factual films. And where I think that then moves over into the kind of blurring between narrative and non-narrative cinema is in films like The Arbor or like Self-Made, where, you know, there is very definitely an element of storytelling, but the stories are told in really unconventional ways. So in The Arbor, you have, you know, recorded documentary testimony lip-synced by actors, interspersed with real documentary footage, interspersed with performance of a theatrical piece. In Self-Made, you have real people coming to a, you know, kind of experiential drama workshop with imagined stories which are then told on film. Now, you know, as I'm describing them, they sound quite, you know, sort of complicated, but actually when you watch them, they're seamless. But it's the idea that, you know, storytelling is always kind of linear, you know, three-act kind of conventional structure. I think there's, you know, I think filmmakers are increasingly playing with that. And actually, one of the things that's great to see is that British filmmakers are doing that. You know, it feels like there's more experiment in, you know, some of the British films than we've seen for a long time.
So that was Sandra Hebron, who's the artistic director of the London Film Festival. And I think it was something that she made clear, and really, really clear in her speech, and when she opened the festival, was that they were really trying to challenge audiences this time. And we should expect not only filmmakers to take a risk, but audiences also. So perhaps the fact that films like My Joy are going to come to London now does really give that opportunity for London audiences to take that risk and to see a film that they might not have picked up on before. And I think London probably does that better than a lot of the other film festivals. It is very much for the people.
So what are your highlights? What are you really looking forward to?
This year I'm looking forward to Submarine, which is the directorial debut by Richard Ayoade of the IT Crowd. Stars Paddy Considine and Sally Hawkins. And there was a clip that they showed at the opening, which was only about 45 seconds long, but it literally got four or five laughs from all these hardened hacks there. So, you know, that looks like something to look out for. Also, Lemmy, which is a documentary about the ex-Hawkwind, now Motorhead, singer and bass player. Film crew followed him for 3 years around his 65th. And it's just come up to his 65th birthday, so that's why they're releasing it now. Again, you know, a massive comedy figure as well as being something of a musical genius.
And talking of challenges, the prospect of the Danny Boyle film, 127 Hours, seems a bit of a challenge and taking a risk to me. It's basically just a guy who gets his arm trapped under a boulder.
Mm. But then if you've seen the trailer, there's the way he shot the trailer, it's very... Dare I say it almost looks like The Beach, which sounds like a horrible proposition from the start. But it's really glossy, high colour.
Right.
There's three young people shouting at each other and being a bit sexy and kind of flirting on a mountaintop.
But then one of them gets his arm trapped under a boulder.
One of them gets his arm trapped in a boulder, and you've got to wonder, where is he going to take it from there? Because you can't keep this kind of high gloss, high colour look to a film where a guy's going to have to get out of that situation, however he got out of that situation.
We have to wait and see, won't we?
You know, I think that could be a fascinating film. Who knows?
Okay. I was saying earlier about the Errol Morris documentary. He's obviously an Oscar-winning American documentary filmmaker. But there's some British ones there too, aren't there?
Yeah, there's a good few, actually, yeah. And one of them who's very significant at the moment is Kim Longinotto, and she's here this year with her new film, Pink Saris. Before, she's done a couple of really great films called Rough Aunties, and before that there was Sisters-in-Law. And Pink Saris, yet again, stars a very strong female figure that Kim's decided to focus on. So I began by asking her what her female protagonist this year is like.
Well, the starting point of the film is a woman called Sampat Powell, who's a kind of... Somebody just called her an agony aunt activist, which I thought was quite neat. I've stolen it off him. But the film then is about the girls that come to her for help, these desperate girls, because Sampat's at a very interesting time in her life. She's becoming almost like too famous. And I think it's really interesting what happens to people all over the world, not just here, when they become too famous and they start losing touch with the people around them in a way. I mean, it's inevitable. So there are these five stories of these, they're quite dramatic stories of five girls that come for help. And they're all on, I mean, most of them are under threat of death of some sort because they've broken all the rules. But also the kind of mores of the village comes into the city. So you read a load of stuff when you get an Indian newspaper of, you know, young people that have got married, a tiny little bit of caste difference, and the family come and kidnap the girl and then she's never seen again. So it's being played out in different ways in the continent. So it's fascinating. And we're sort of filming these very raw and dramatic stories as they happen. So the film is quite dramatic. And at times, Amber, who made the film with me, and I would look at each other and we'd think, wow, what did we just film? You know, because it is actually very dramatic.
You've had films at the London Film Festival before. Yeah. How does it feel to show these very international films in your hometown, in the localised area?
Well, actually, last year we didn't show at the film festival here because there's all this pressure. All the festivals want premieres, and IDFA, the film festival in Amsterdam, said you can only show in one festival before us, and it's this whole thing. So I didn't go to Sheffield, didn't go to London. And this year I thought, where I really want to show it is London. I absolutely love showing the film in London. So I just thought, no, I'm going to have London. And so we're not in competition in IDFA, which would have been nice, but we're in London and Sheffield. So so I'm really pleased, and I love it.
That's Kim Longinotto there. And you spoke to another female British director too.
Yeah, it was a real wealth of talent in terms of British directors at the opening, and particularly female directors, which you don't often see. But the third person we spoke to was Joanna Hogg, who won the International Critics Award in 2007 with her first film, Unrelated.
She won a Guardian Award for that as well.
She won a Guardian Award. I think Peter Bradshaw raved about it. And what did you think of it?
I thought it was really good. Really good. I mean, it's one of those films that it's basically a little delicate middle-class nightmare. And at first, when you start watching it, all you see is the sort of the middle-class people prancing around by the swimming pool out in wherever they are on holiday. And then it gradually builds and it completely draws you in. So I'm really interested to see what she's done next.
What she's done next is, by all intents and purposes, a companion piece to her first film. So it's, again, a kind of middle-class drama with a troubled father figure involved. And I asked her how this story develops, and also interestingly, she shot on the Scilly Isles, which I think the last time something significant that shot there was Challenge Annika way back in the 90s.
So it's a rich cinematic heritage there.
So Joanna had plenty to talk about when it came to her new film.
It's called Archipelago, and it came about after I had been struggling for maybe a year after I finished Unrelated and it came out. The pressure was on, obviously, for the next film. It's about a family staying on a remote island, and they're struggling to contain volcanic anger at the sort of triggered by the absence of the father. They're waiting for him to arrive, and it's very tense. And I think families are often linked together by what is sort of in a way unspoken and unacknowledged. So it's all about what is beneath the surface, which is similar in terms of a sort of theme to Unrelated, but in a very, very different context. And I would say with greater intensity, in a sense.
So would it be fair to say that this is a companion piece to Unrelated, in that it shares similar themes like the overbearing father?
Yes, I mean, I actually wouldn't say the father's overbearing. It's just that he's absent, he's not there. So there's a big void within the story, in a sense. And actually, the character, there's an actor called Tom Hiddleston who was in Unrelated, and he's also in Archipelago. But I would say you will hardly recognise him, because the character he's playing in Archipelago is very, very different to what he played in Unrelated. But you're right, it is a kind of companion piece, but very different setting, obviously very different story and characters, but the sort of approach, very similar.
So your first film was shot in Tuscany. Where was this one shot? Can you tell us a bit about the location?
This was shot in an actual archipelago, a little group of islands off Cornwall called the Scilly Isles. And we shot on one of those islands, which was very nice. It's quite a remote island. There are no cars, and we were living there for a couple of months. And actually, I didn't really want to move back to the mainland.
That's Joanna Hogg there, bringing the spirit of the Scilly Islands to London this autumn. Thanks to the intrepid Henry Barnes there. And for a full lineup of the London Film Festival, go to bfi.org.uk/LFF. And that's all for this week. But for the best movie news and reviews, go to guardian.co.uk/film. The music featured in the show comes from the brooding and altogether wonderful score to Winter's Bone by the Tindersticks' Dickon Hinchcliffe. But for now, from me, Zan Brooks, and Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's farewell until next week. You all come back and see us, you hear?